This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
Thanks for tuning in to 93.3 CFMU Radio Progressive Voices. This is Riaz Sainimalji, and today I'm joined over the phone by Anthony Black. Tony has been a freelance journalist and political essayist for the past 25 years, in addition to being an educator, though writing largely for independent media like Mayday Magazine, where he served as global affairs editor and a regular columnist. Tony's work has also appeared in the mainstream press. Tony, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
All right, so today we're going to be talking about the Rwandan genocide. Tony, to start off, could you give our listeners a brief summary of what was the common mainstream Western account of the Rwandan genocide?
Sure. The mainstream view was that there was basically some sort of virus of tribal irrationalism that just erupted sort of inexplicably and spread through Rwanda. And a group called the Hutus, which were the majority population, 85% majority population of Rwanda, committed a genocide, or near genocide, against the minority 15% Tutsis. This was never explained. There was never any background given to this. And it flew in the face of much of the actual information that was coming out at the time. So, for instance, when these events took place in April of 1994, we were never told, for instance, that on the basically on the night when all the troubles really started, which was April 6, 1994, that the president's plane coming in from Tanzania had been shot down. So Juvenal Habyarimana, the Hutu president of Rwanda, and Cyprien Ntaryamira, the Hutu president of Burundi, were both killed on that plane, along with a few French nationals, soldiers. This was never really reported, and if it was reported, it was just tossed off as some sort of with some bizarre story, as though some Hutu rebels had, for some inexplicable reasons, decided to kill their own president for some, again, unexplained reason. This was later sort of completely trashed when a report by Michael Hirgen, who was an Australian lawyer, and who was commissioned by the chief prosecutor at the time, Louise Arbour, of the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, and he came forth with the knowledge that, in fact, the RPF, the Rwandan Patriotic Force, which was supposedly the saviors of Rwanda coming in from Uganda, were the ones who had basically shot down the plane. And this was never reported, nor was it reported that there was a 30,000-man army, Rwandan Patriotic Force army, coming from Uganda that invaded that very night. So many of these contextual political factors were completely eluded from the press, the mainstream press. And it was just taken, the word was just taken on faith from the RPF itself, that there was a genocide coming to which they were responding. And so that's the mainstream view, but again, it contradicts most of the actual facts on the ground.
All right, so could you explain a bit more what actually happened in Rwanda, and not just during the period known as genocide, but the aftermath?
The aftermath. Well, the aftermath, we should probably go, before we look at the aftermath, we should look at the immediate, the preceding period, say from 1990. From 1990 on, the Rwandan Patriotic Force, which was a Tutsi expatriate force, which was part of Museveni's army in Uganda, made up a large part of his army, and was based in Uganda, had been doing cross-border raids and so forth on Rwanda for years. As a result of this military pressure, and also as a result of the U.S. Economic and political pressure, there was the Rwandan one-party socialist state, the MRND, sort of decided to form a power-sharing arrangement with the Tutsis and eventually bring them back into government. Now, there were a lot of Tutsis in the armed forces to begin with anyway, so it's not true that the Rwandan government, the FAR, the MRND, was entirely Hutu. It wasn't. It had many Tutsi forces in it. But the elite Tutsis who had fled from the initial 1959 revolution and had gone to Uganda, you know, they wanted power back. And so they were, during this pressure put on by the United States and Britain and Belgium, they were allowed to form a multi-party government in Rwanda, I think around 1992. But they weren't content with just forming that government, so they took over many of the civilian ministries and so forth. But at the same time, they did a talk-and-fight strategy where they would sort of put political pressure on the government. At the same time, they would engage in guerrilla tactics. So there's still a lot of cross-border raids, there's a lot of civilian killings, and so forth. So there's a state of heightened tension throughout this period from 1990 to 1994. In 1993, the Arusha Accords were signed, in which there was an election that was supposed to be set up, which would formally set the government for Rwanda. Now the problem, the fly in the ointment of this for the RPF, was that they only formed 15% of the population, and so they were not likely to win. And so they set about not trying to win, really. They set about their sort of final solution, which was a military solution. And the military solution accorded with the geostrategic aims of the United States, and that sort of is a whole other, sort of story in itself. You know, like why was the United States interested in taking over Rwanda? Well, it was partly because it was a doorway to the Eastern Congo, where all of the natural resources are: uranium, gold, zinc, coltan, all these things. A lot of Canadian companies are in there mining these things. They like the place divided up and in chaos, so they can go in there and just do what they want. In fact, the Rwandan government had been approached by the United States, I think, early in the 1990s, to be used as a staging ground for an attack on the Congo, and Habyarimana, the president of Rwanda, had refused. And that's when the United States just went, well, we're going to overthrow them, and we're going to use these Tutsis, this expatriate Tutsi force, the RPF, in Uganda, to effect that. Right. So the aftermath after what happened on April 6th, of course, 1994, was the president's plane was shot down. The government was effectively decapitated. At the same time, a massive armed force invaded from Uganda, 30,000-man armed force invaded. And also, there was also a fifth column element that had been built up in Kigali, 15,000 men. Now, under the Arusha Accords, which was supposedly being administered by the UN, and who Romeo Dallaire was supposed to have been in, you know, he was supposed to be in control of all this. Only 600 RPF forces were supposed to have been in Kigali at the time. But it's clear from UN documents that Dallaire allowed and was aware that there were massive shipments of arms and men and machinery and stuff being infiltrated into Kigali. On April 6th, 15,000 RPF rose up and started attacks all through Kigali, right? Basically there. So then here we have this huge civil war. U.S. Hercules helicopters, C-130 helicopters, were involved in supplying the RPF. So this was clearly a U.S.-backed coup d'etat, you know, and it was put off as a genocide, and most of the West accepted it. You know, of course, the media totally accepted it. And what's a little bit disturbing is that the left in North America and Europe basically accepted the story as well, which is, again, it's its own separate story.
So how is such a massive cover-up of what happened actually made possible? You mentioned the media had a role to play, but what were some of the tools used by the media to enable this myth that there was a genocide that took place as opposed to a coup d'etat?
Well, it was not just the media, but there were many NGOs. The role of supposedly neutral NGOs in many of these humanitarian imperialist ventures throughout the world, in Libya and Yugoslavia and so forth. That's a separate tale, and it's been told many times before. But just to give an example, I believe it was March 8, 1993, Human Rights Watch issued a report saying that there was a genocide that was taking place, and it was affected by the Rwandan government against the Tutsi population. This is before really any genocide had started. It completely delegitimized the MRND government in advance and legitimized the claims of the RPF when it was coming in that they were responding to a genocide. And in fact, there's been no evidence whatsoever that there was a planned genocide by the government. There have been no documents presented at any of the ICTR trials, Military 1, Military 2 trials. None of them. There was only one famous document, the so-called genocide facts document, which Romeo Dallaire was heavily implicated in, which purported to have some kind of being some kind of documentary evidence that there was a plan. And it was one fax. It was later proven by and I think that was submitted in November of 1995, and it was apparently written in January 11th, 1994. And it was sent by Romeo Dallier. Now, Romeo Dallier did send a fax, but it had nothing to do with a genocide. It had to do with just minor troop movements and so forth, and weapons arrays and so forth. The document that was put in to the trial, ICTR, was a copy. My brother, Christopher Black, who was one of the defense attorneys at the time in the trial, basically he went and found the original. And the original was completely different than the copy. And they completely demolished it on the stand and showed that it was a fraud, that it had been fraudulently entered, that it didn't contain what they said it did. Now, what's interesting is that Dallier had later supported the idea that this was a genocide fax document. And in fact, it's been shown to be completely fraudulent. It is nowhere mentioned. It's never been brought up since. It's an embarrassment to the trial, and no one even mentions it anymore. And that was the only piece of evidence, factual piece of evidence, that was presented to say that the government had been engaged in some kind of planned genocide. All the evidence seems to be that the RPF, if anyone, was doing systematic killings. And this came out very early on. A man by the name of Robert Gersony, who worked for USAID, did a report, I believe, in October of 1995 or 6 or something, and he basically said, listen, I went in there and I was looking at what was going on, and in all the areas controlled by the RPF, they were doing systematic killings of women and children, mass killings, hundreds of thousands, and that's the only mass killings, systematic killings I saw. That report was basically suppressed. It came up in trial, though, because, again, my brother found it in the electronic disclosure files that the prosecution gave to them. They didn't realize what they'd given them because it was just a morass of just these just hundreds of thousands of files, not ordered in any way or not labeled, so they had to just go through them and just see what they were. There was also a recent report in Le Monde in August of 2010. It was a UN draft report which was leaked to Le Monde and which definitely showed that the RPF, following the killings in Rwanda from April through July of 1994, then pursued the remnants Hutu army and refugees into the Congo, and between 1993 and 2003, over 11-year period, killed upwards of 1 million or more, perhaps 2 million people, and systematically murdered them. And now this report is now part of the historical record, and it's being not commented on at all in the Western press, but it was in the European press. So again, all the documentary evidence seems to suggest that it was the RPF that was engaged in the systematic killing. There was also some reports by U.S. academics, Christian Davenport and Alan Stamm, who in 2004 and again in 2009 from the University of Maryland, who basically said, of the killings that took place in Rwanda through April to July of 1994, the majority killed were Hutus, not Tutsis. Right? It was like a 2-to-1 ratio. Now, there were a lot of civilian-on-civilian killings, but again, there's a whole story behind that as well.
All right, Tony, so would you argue that Romeo Dallaire and the rest of the United Nations peacekeepers were complicit in what took place? And how do you see the example of Rwanda fitting into broader trends of Canadian foreign policy and this notion of peacekeeping?
Right. There's no doubt that Dallaire was complicit. It's hard to know whether how much he knew what was to take place, whether he realized how many people were going to be killed or whatever. But definitely he was aware of the infiltration of RPF troops in the Kogali. There's many other things that he was aware of. I mean, there was a lot of strange things that went down. His movements on the night of April 6, 1984 are very, very suspicious. I mean, there was a number of Belgian troops, for instance, in a UN compound who were shot. They were considered, we think that they were the Belgian shoot-down team for the plane, and probably helped by the RPF. There was the Prime Minister, Agat, who was Willingenyimana, forget her name now, who was murdered that night in the UN compound. He was in that compound, and there was nothing ever done. His headquarters was at Amohodero Stadium, and there were RPF troops coming in there all the time and taking people out and shooting them. And and he was present. I mean, there's a lot of stuff going down there. When the RPF arose in Kigali, all the Belgian troops, right, They had three placements around in the hills around Kigali. They left their placements. They just completely gave them up. They left all their weapons intact and let the RPF take over them and basically take over Kigali. So this idea that the government was you know, doing systematic killings, they weren't in any place to do the killings. There's only about 5,000 troops, and the RPF was in almost total control of the country. In fact, on the night, within a few, I think on the very night of the attack, they issued a surrender notice, which was refused by the RPF. And then on, I think, April 12th, they issued another one, unconditional surrender. Again, it was refused. And then you have to look at the whole background just prior to all this, when Boutros Ghali, who was the UN Secretary General of the time, he received a notice, I believe in May of 1994, from Habyarimana, the president of the Rwandan Hutu president of Rwanda, and who asking for the UN troops to be bolstered, to have more troops come in. And that was completely nixed by the Clinton administration, who took it off the UN agenda. And instead, when the attack started on April 6th, the 2,500 troops that were there were lifted out. I mean, that was the first thing that caught my attention way back when, before I knew anything about anything. That was reported in the papers, and I just thought, that is bizarre. I mean, how can you, you know, you've got these supposed mass killings of people just with machetes, and you've got guys with machine guns, 2,500 of them, and you can't resupply them, so you lift them out? You know, and this complete contradiction was never reported on in the press. It was never commented on, right? Nor was it commented on the fact that the people who were supposedly be genocided against ended up as the victors in this strange, bizarre drama. They ended up in control of the country. So Paul Kagame, who's the head of the RPF and head of the Rwanda to this day, I mean, he's been accused by many people of being a war criminal. And if I might add, some of your readers might find this interesting, that the real life hero of the movie Hotel Rwanda, Paul Rusesabagina, who, I mean, that was a movie that, you know, basically promoted the official version of the story, that the Hutus government had done all the killing. He completely gainsaid that narrative time and time again in a number of interviews and said, no, it was the RPF that did all the killing, that Paul Kagame is the war criminal, and that even to this day, within Rwanda, he's a dictator and has killed tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people. And now Paul Rusesabagina is basically persona non grata in Rwanda, where they have an official crime now, which is genocide denial. You cannot even, you know, rebut the crime, you know, because... Anyway, so the ICTR, again, it showed itself right off the bat to be a kangaroo court. It didn't allow any political context to be brought in. It didn't allow, for instance, no RPF officers were ever charged for any crimes. Only the Hutu generals and soldiers were ever tried. When Carlo Del Ponte, who took over as chief prosecutor after Louise Arbour, when she tried to set up a special investigation which would at least look at the RPF crimes, she was dismissed. She was dismissed by Kofi Annan, who was the UN Secretary General at that time. He had taken over from Boutros Ghali, who had almost thwarted the whole coup by actually acceding to the request of the Rwandan government to have UN troops flown in. Now, it's interesting that Kofi Annan was head of the peacekeeping operations in 1994, so he's complicit in all that as well. So here you have the U.S., which was supporting, not only through troops and men, I mean, they had special forces in there, as did the Canadians. We think there are Canadian special forces in there. But there was UN involvement. The media was completely on board supporting the coup, and just parroted anything the RPF and the U.S. said, and so forth. And again, some of these NGOs were part and parcel of this whole charade, right? So you basically have an incredible Orwellian story here, where black is white, where the people who were basically genocided against and were defending themselves were then later victimized as the genocideers. And as far as you mentioned Canadian policy. This fits in with a growing tendency in Canadian policy. I mean, the myth of Canadian peacekeeping has always been that ever since the Vietnam War, ever since we were involved in setting up Palestine with and helping the Zionists set up Palestine in 1949. But it's grown worse over the last, certainly over the last 20 years, where we've become very little more than just a sub-imperial partner of the U.S. And it's a scandal. It's a scandal. We're spending billions of dollars on C-135s and, you know, all these jets and everything, and for what? So that we can promote U.S. imperialism abroad. That's basically the name of the game.
All right, Tony, just to wrap up, is there a website or a email that our listeners can reach you at?
I just have an email at the moment. I'd like to set up a blog at some point, but my email is tal1@kojiko.ca.
Perfect. Tony, I'd like to thank you so much for doing the interview. This was very informative, very enlightening, a subject that's not touched upon in mainstream media at all, really.
And right, especially when you consider what we just did in Libya, which was just an absolute tragedy.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, we're seeing trends of peacekeeping, or at least imperial ventures being branded as peacekeeping, and
that's
a
right.
problem.
I think the word humanitarian imperialism really covers it beautifully. I mean, it's the contradiction in terms is very poignant, you know.
Oh, for sure. All right, Tony, thanks so much once again. For our listeners, make sure to reach Tony by email and check out his writing on Mayday Magazine. And there's also some stuff available on the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War website, Essays on Rwanda.
Thank you for having me, Riaz.
No problem. All right, this is Progressive Voices, 93.3 CFMU Radio. I'm Riaz Sanimolji, and I'll talk to you next week.